Dear friends, I am honored today as president of the Association of Jewish New Americans to welcome the committee of the Holocaust Conference to Philadelphia, the first city in this country to form such a committee to further the interest of the Holocaust studies. It's also the first city in this country to erect a monument to the 6 million martyrs. Like the creator of this culture, we too must forge something, not with our hands, but with our voices. We survivors of the Holocaust are alive by our miracles. Our legacy must be passed to the young and old, Jew and non-Jew alike, to remind the world there was a Holocaust. We cannot remain silent in the face of those who wish to discredit us, who wish to say the Holocaust never happened. It is our duty that the truth be known to the future generations in order to prevent another genocide. Never would we allow to close the book on one of men's most terrible chapters in history. It is up to all of us to educate and inform the young and all the youth in the world so that the world doesn't forget, so that future generations may be spared such anguish. Fortunately, the young will be the bearers of our message. There are reasons to be optimistic because of some of our schools teach Holocaust courses, and many of our children and even some of our grandchildren attended a Mosul world gathering of the Holocaust survivors last spring in Israel. Nevertheless, we must continue to encourage more Holocaust TV programs, more educational tools, so that no one who said it didn't happen, it's all a Zionist hoax, will ever be taken seriously. Let us not forget how in a different world turned away, how the Western allies refused to believe the mass genocide taking place. There is nothing we can do to restore the 6 million lives lost in the Holocaust. But we can and will ensure their memories live on.
To introduce someone who is hard to introduce, because just talking about him, you could really give a little talk in itself. Rabbi Mark Tannenbaum is going to speak to us tonight, and he's going to address the lessons of the Holocaust for a pluralistic society. And I'm delighted that Mark will be able to do it because he comes to us from that world scene. And I'd like to, for the sake of those who might not know many of the things that Mark is involved in, I would like to mention just a few. Mark comes to us as the National Interreligious Affairs Director of the American Jewish Committee, and he has been a pioneer in interreligious relations and social justice movements during the past 30 years. Newsweek magazine has described him as, quote, the American Jewish community's foremost apostle to the Gentiles, who has been able to solicit support from all factions of the Jewish community. A poll of American newspaper religious editors in 1978 voted Rabbi Tannenbaum one of the 10 most respected and influential religious leaders in America. And the citation of his 15th honorary degree characterized him as the human rights rabbi of America. President Carter invited Rabbi Tannenbaum as the American Jewish leader among 10 national religious spokesmen to discuss the state of the nation at Camp David summit meetings in 1979. The rabbi was also the Jewish spokesman at the January 1980 White House Conference on Energy and Conservation. He's presently chairman of the Technical Committee on the Media of the 1981 White House Conference on Aging. He's been a major force in the promotion of social justice and human rights. At the invitation of the International Rescue Committee, I remember hearing Mark speaking of the fact that he was there when he saw a boatload of refugees sinking, and people standing by, not only watching, but some cheering. as people, the boat people as we know them, went down. Recently, he served as the consultant to the NBC TV 9-hour special Holocaust, and earlier was consultant to the special Jesus of Nazareth program. President Carter appointed Mark Tenenbaum to serve on the advisory committee of the President's Commission on the Holocaust. Rabbi Tenenbaum was the only rabbi at Vatican Council II, and he is a founder and co-secretary of the Joint Vatican International Jewish Consultative Committee, as well as of a similar liaison body with the World Council of Churches. He also participated in the first official audience of world Jewish leaders with Pope John Paul II. He's lectured at major universities, seminaries, religious and educational bodies in the United States. He's the author of many articles and books, and we're just very happy tonight that he could take time out of his busy schedule to speak to us about the world scene and address our conference. Rabbi Tenenbaum.
Dear friend, Sister Gloria, Reverend clergy, and friends, I needed every inch of that introduction tonight. It's essential that I tell you at the outset something about my state of orientation or disorientation, because I'm sure that will have some effect on the nature of my presentation this evening. Last week, on Thursday morning, week before that actually, which is already a sign of my disorientation, I went to Houston, Texas to attend the meeting of National Jewish Leadership called by the American Jewish Committee. Stayed there for 2 days for a consultation which dealt with the problems of many aspects of American foreign policy and domestic policy, in particular concerns about certain aspects of extreme forms of new right political activity. And then a quite extraordinary session we had with the World Council of Churches with Professor Christer Stendahl, dealing with a new set of guidelines adopted by the World Council of Churches, remarkable in itself, in the final recognition by the World Council of Churches of the centrality of the Holocaust and its meaning not only for Jews but for world Christendom. And then I had to leave toward the end of that week on Sunday for a rather urgent meeting that was called between our group, the International Jewish Committee for Interreligious Consultations, and the Vatican Secretariat of State. It was an off-the-record meeting held in Rome on Tuesday, a meeting with no publicity by common consent, and it was called for the purpose of enabling us to meet for the first time officially with the Vatican Secretariat of State and representatives of the world Jewish community to deal with some concerns, including some recent meetings between Cardinal Cassavoli and representatives of the PLO, and the rather extraordinary role of a man called Archbishop Cappucci. There was a one-day meeting, and then I turned around to come back here to the States to go off to Princeton University, where NBC TV called a conference of some 60 national religious, civic, and ethnic leaders to consider the role of the mass media and values in the media. So I think I am going to have to ask your indulgence this evening if you begin to realize that having lost 6 hours going across the ocean and then gained 6 hours coming back, if there are moments here tonight where it appears that I'm not sure whether I'm coming or going, that there's some biological basis for that condition. Not my normal condition, although some people believe that's a normal aberration with me. I began to feel the other day that someone was talking about a leader, and they said, he's a lovely guy and he's very effective. The problem is he needs a charisma transplant. And if I continue working on this kind of schedule, I may need something comparable to that. I heard Henny Youngman a couple weeks ago say that, talking about the state of his energy and his appeal to audiences, he said, you know, I had charisma as a kid, but then it cleared up. I think pretty much that happened to me somewhere across the ocean. I'm really very grateful to this Philadelphia Committee on Holocaust Studies for inviting me to come here this evening and to share some reflections with you. Philadelphia holds a very special place in the consciousness of the Jewish people. And indeed, I would say, from the perspective of history, if one may prophesy in that way, I dare say when one looks at the course of the 20th century and seeks to record the highest quality of moral and spiritual and human leadership, which began to try to understand the magnitude of the meaning of the Nazi Holocaust in our lifetime for the century, few will stand in the front ranks with such distinction as many of the Christian and Jewish leaders who are here in this room this evening. I have in mind our chairperson, Sister Gloria Coleman, above all Dr. Franklin Littell, whom I think many of you ought to know, has paid more than once a supreme price for his insistence on truth and integrity with regard to facing the Nazi experience and its meaning, not just for Jews, but its final fundamental meaning for Christendom. Frank, whom I regard as a brother and dear friend, together with Rufus Cornelson and many others in this room, are among the greatest sources of consolation to my colleagues and myself. And I've been working in the area of Jewish-Christian relations now some 30 years. And while indeed there has been, I believe, exceedingly great progress made over this period of time in the facing of the sources of anti-Semitism and certain traditions of Christian teaching, and while I know, in fact, from our own studies and our own work with Catholic, Protestant, evangelical publishers, that we have moved light years over the past decades in overcoming stereotypes and misunderstanding, there's still much yet to go. But I am persuaded that much of that achievement will find its spiritual engine emerging out of the city, and I came here tonight to acknowledge with the deepest gratitude the commitment, the devotion, and the love of our Christian friends here who have joined with Jewish neighbors in facing this searing chapter in human history. I heard a story. It's not a very funny story, but it's a kind of perverse way or inverted way of getting at the subject tonight. Story of a man who was found beating his wife rather badly. And he was brought before a judge. And the judge said, well, I'm going to send you to prison for that. What do you think about that? The man said, Judge, have some mercy. You want to spoil our honeymoon? There is a certain sense, some of it quite objective, fact-based, that relationships between the Jewish people and many in the Roman Catholic community, many in the liberal Protestant community still, increasingly among evangelical Christians, Greek Orthodox, and more latterly as we've begun to work with the Hispanic community, that there has been something of a sense of a kind of honeymoon atmosphere, certainly an improved atmosphere having emerged over recent decades in our mutual understanding and our mutual respect. And having visited almost every city in the United States over the past several years, meeting with Christian and Jewish leaders, I think that is a quite valid conclusion to come to. But I must tell you that as I have traveled recently in almost every region of the United States, I am beginning to become troubled as to how long that honeymoon atmosphere, or certainly that improved atmosphere, can persist. And among the troubling signs that I find is that there is emerging, even among friends, at least ostensible friends, in the Christian community, a certain kind of fatigue. Fatigue about Israel, fatigue about wanting even to talk anymore about the Nazi Holocaust. Not incidentally, as some of you may know, as Sister Gloria indicated, I have been deeply involved, continue to be involved in the world refugee problem. And I believe it's not unrelated. While America has justifiably every reason to be proud of the extraordinary record we have played in saving human lives, especially with regard to Southeast Asian, Vietnamese boat people and Cambodians, there is now developing among refugee specialists what they are quaintly, not so quaintly, calling compassion fatigue. We're getting tired of these refugees. Getting tired of these illegal aliens. I suppose I became most concerned when one Christian leader said to me not too long ago, you know, Mark, I'm a great friend of the Jewish people. I have been involved in dialogue and relationships for many years now. I've got to tell you that I'm becoming upset about being invited to attend so many meetings by Jews to talk about, again, the Nazi Holocaust. And he said this in the intimacy of our friendship, what's going on with the Jewish psyche? I mean, this Holocaust has become a Jewish obsession. It's a kind of Jewish hang-up. When are the Jews going to begin to forgive and forget? And I said something to him in my state of shock, especially coming from an ostensible friend. We will never forget. We may learn to forgive, but Jews may only begin to learn to forget, if that were ever possible, only when the Christian world begins to remember. A I want to come back to that in a few moments. So there is now developing a fatigue about a great many moral human issues in our society, but a peculiar kind of fatigue about wanting to deal with the Holocaust as the watershed event, as Frank Littell rightly calls it, the watershed event of the 20th century. Others, as Sister Gloria has indicated, for far more pathological reasons, are trying to deny that a Holocaust ever took place. Hoax, myth of the Holocaust. Professors of electrical engineering suddenly become specialists in European history, writing books about the myth of the Holocaust, the hoax of the Holocaust. And others simply have never remembered. We did a study last year after I'd served as the consultant to NBC in the preparation of the Holocaust series. We did a survey in high schools in Seattle, Washington, and found out in classrooms, in a class of some 30, 40 students, when children were asked what they knew about the Nazi Holocaust, average representative Americans, what do they know about the Holocaust? What do you think the Holocaust is? One of the questions said in the questionnaire. 7 children in the class answered, I think the Nazi Holocaust is a Jewish holiday. So much for history, social science education. Is this a Jewish obsession? Is there something perverse about the Jewish psyche and mentality? Or is there something in the depths of the confrontation of the demonology that is involved at the heart of the Nazi experience that has the profoundest meaning for the human family today? I want to suggest to you that unless and until the Christian world begins indeed to face the Nazi Holocaust in the depth of its moral meaning for mankind, and understand that what Mr. Teitelbaum and the other survivors in this nation are testifying to holds the very secret of the possibility of human survival in the kind of world in which we live today, unless that is comprehended by the Christian world, I literally fear for the capacity of the human family to develop the moral resolve and the social resources to be able to deal with the blackest legacy of the Nazi Holocaust, which now verges on erupting as an epidemic that has the capacity to consume the whole of mankind. I want to tell you why I come to what to you may appear to be a melodramatic conclusion. And I want to explain that in terms of human, not just broad propositional statements, philosophical analyses. Philosophical analyses can allow for an Arthur Butz even to write a book and remain a member in good standing in a faculty of a major university. I want to share with you, out of my own life experience, what I have seen with my eyes, I've touched with my hands, what I mean about the Christian stake, the human stake in facing the meaning of the Nazi Holocaust, the meaning of evil in the kind of world in which we live today, and what consequences we could well face unless we comprehend what is at stake here for everyone. And overcome this deep bias of somehow wanting to reduce the magnitude of this trauma by dismissing it as a provincial preoccupation of this parochial people called Jews. It is a form of repression. I want to tell you two stories. Some of you may have heard these before. They bear telling again, especially here at this assembly. The first story began for me when, in February 1978, I received a telephone call from a man named Dr. Leo Chern, the president of the International Rescue Committee. He told me that the International Rescue Committee, which had been in operation since the end of World War II, saving survivors of the Nazi Holocaust, foremost among them people like Einstein and Enrico Fermi and others, was organizing a delegation of 14 prominent American leaders to go to Southeast Asia to investigate the plight of the Vietnamese boat people, ethnic Chinese, the Laotians, and others. And he called me on a day in which I was heavily preoccupied with my normal affairs at the American Jewish Committee. And I said to Dr. Chern, Dr. Chern, look, of course I'm interested in the plight of refugees. I'd like to be helpful. I know that the International Rescue Committee had been helpful to many survivors of the Nazi Holocaust. Of course I'd want to be helpful, but I've got a schedule that'll choke a cow, and I'm busy for the next 4 or 5 weeks. Is it possible to arrange for the delegation to leave a month later? And then, of course, I'll change my schedule. And Leo Chern, himself a Jew, said, listen, Rabbi, you don't seem to understand what is taking place in the South China Sea now, not a month from now. There were 8,000-10,000 refugees being driven out of Vietnam every month. They were turned back from the shores of almost every country, great third world brothers and sisters. Turned back almost every boat that came to their shores. And Chern said to me, Tannenbaum, 60%, an estimated 60% of these Vietnamese boat people and other refugees are sinking in the South China Sea before the eyes of the world. You're going to tell me you have no time for that? And I said, okay, Leo, let's go. And within a week, I joined a delegation of 14 American leaders, among them James Michener, the novelist, William Casey, now the head of CIA. He and I shared a room next to each other in a number of the countries we went to. And I told him later on we shared rooms in Singapore. If I knew he was being prepared to become the head of the CIA, I'd lock my door every night with locking key. Ambassador Cecil Lyon, the former American Ambassador Salon, Byard Rustin, James Richardson, a former Assistant Secretary of State, many others, Catholic priests, Protestant scholar, myself. We went as an American delegation inspired by our government, which asked us to carry out this, the White House, then under President Jimmy Carter. We went to every major refugee camp in Southeast Asia, Hong Kong, Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, the Philippines, Singapore. The story I want to tell you out of that welter of experiences began on this day in February in Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia. I came out into the harbor with Casey. He went off elsewhere. I walked across a rotten wharf under the broiling sun in that capital city of Jakarta, Indonesia. There at the foot of that wharf, there was a skiff, a battered ship, exhausted from having sailed some 4 or 5 weeks, as I was later to learn, across the South China Sea. At the head of the ship was a short brown man, his wife, sister-in-law, some children sitting behind him, playing in the boat. I jumped from that rotted wharf onto the skiff. I introduced myself. I'm Rabbi Tannenbaum of the American Jewish Committee. I am here with a delegation of the International Rescue Committee. We are here to find out a factual report about what is happening with refugees. And we're called upon to bring it back to the President of the United States and members of Congress, as we were to do later on. The man introduced himself, his name was Yen Tan. And this is his story, briefly. His family had lived in Saigon for centuries. He was a Roman Catholic high school teacher in Saigon. And one day, his house was broken into by a group of soldiers from North Vietnam. And they told him, tomorrow you and your family are to leave. You are to go out to the countryside where you are to be re-educated. Forcibly re-educated in the collective farm. We're creating a new society and a new man. Never mind what you have been. You are to become what we tell you to become. And Yen Tan said that he turned to his wife and children after they had left, and they decided that was no future for them to have their dignity literally taken away from them, the power of the deciding who they are, what they are to be. And so that night they rendezvoused with his brother in the forest. They got through the forest, reached the coast of Vietnam, 4 o'clock in the morning. There they took whatever possessions they had and they bought this battered skiff from a fisherman. They set sail in the South China Sea, and he said that we sailed for some 4 weeks. Everywhere we tried to land, we would turn back. No one wanted refugees. He said, by the 3rd week, as we sailed across the South China Sea, we were without food and without water. Our children began drinking seawater and eating seaweed. They began to become deathly ill. Growing up, fever, tearing their bodies apart, screaming in terror at night, couldn't go to sleep. Yen Tan said, ships pass us by. Every day we watch ships pass us by. We counted 23 cargo ships, massive cargo ships. We waved our white flag, our undershirts at them, asking them to stop. We found out later on there was no point asking them to stop, to pick us up. All we wanted was to get some water and rice so that we could survive until we came to some haven. None of them stopped. None of the ships of the great nations of the earth that passed by, France and Italy and Liberia and Panama, none of them stopped. Yes, he said, some of the ships, 3 of the ships slowed down. The crew came up to look at us and they began laughing. We were their entertainment to break the boredom of their travel. And then Yen Tan turned to me and said in these words, Rabbi, I cannot begin to tell you what it means to stand there and watch your wife and children literally begin to die before your eyes. But then I learned there was something worse than hunger and starvation. It is to be abandoned by the world. He said, you know, Rabbi, when I was a student in Catholic Mission High School, I learned something about World War II, and they said something to us about the Jews in Nazi Germany and how terrible it was. It meant nothing to me. I now know what it means to have been a Jew in Nazi Germany in the 1930s. Nothing. Nothing is more destructive to the human personality, not even hunger and thirst. Nothing is more destructive than to learn that human life has become worthless. That the life of you and your children mean nothing to the human family. That ships can pass you by, that a world can pass you by and act as if you mean nothing more than the flotsam of the sea. You can drown and nobody will bat an eyelash. And I have to tell you what happened to me at that moment. I was not sure, as I have said on other occasions, whether it was because of the heat, the exhaustion of working 12, 14 hours a day, going from camp to camp. But as I stood there and looked Yen Tan in the face with his eyes burning in passion, I suddenly found my head flooded as if by some television screen with the words 1939. Suddenly, the image of the first boat people of my experience in this generation flooded my head. So St. Louis. I remember the first boat people of this generation. 940 Jewish men, women, and children set sail out of Hamburg, the last ship to leave Germany. Like the Vietnamese and the ethnic Chinese, they begged, borrowed, and stole to get the money to buy visas from the government of Cuba. Cuba had sent an official delegate to Hamburg to sell visas to the Jews who were going to leave, took every nickel they had, guarantees that when they come to Havana, Cuba, they will be allowed to land. Some 700 of the Jews who got onto St. Louis went to the American consulate and obtained landing immigration certificates just in case something should go wrong. They learned something about trusting governments in their life. And so they set sail not across the South China Sea, they set sail across the turbulent North Atlantic Ocean. And they finally, after some weeks, landed in the harbor of Havana. The captain of the ship happened to have been a devout Dutch Christian. And when the ship landed in harbor and he was greeted by a delegation from the government of Cuba, he handed over to them the immigration certificates to the government of Cuba. And the representatives of President Federico Brühl said to him, "These landing immigration certificates are invalid." And the Dutch captain said, "What do you mean they're invalid? They were paid for. Every one of them was purchased. They were given as legal documents. They have the official stamp of Cuba." The response was, "The president of Cuba has determined that they are invalid. If you want to land, you are to raise $1 million by the next day, and we will allow you to land." The captain of the ship cabled the Jewish Joint Distribution Committee in Hayas, who flew in delegations to Havana. They met with President Federico Brühl and pleaded with him, "Let them land here temporarily." President Brühl said, "No, the immigration certificates are invalid. We will want something like $1 million within 24 hours. And then he delivered himself of a lovely aside. "We know the Jews in New York can do that sort of thing. They can provide $1 million in 24 hours. Otherwise, we send them back to sea." And the leaders of JDC and Hayas pleaded with them, "If you send them back to sea, President Brühl, you are assuring them their certain death certificates if they go back to Germany." He would hear nothing of it. So JDC and Hayas sent cables, urgent cables, to the president and foreign minister of every government in Latin America, Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Peru, Uruguay, Paraguay. Most of those enlightened countries did not even bother to answer. And the few that did answer, answered in that classic biblical phrase, "Sorry, there is no room at the inn." Came the next day, the ship was pushed out to sea. And the St. Louis came to the edge of Miami. All of the members of that tragic family climbed aboard the top of the ship, looked out, saw the lights twinkling in Miami, Collins Avenue, Fontainebleau Hotel, all the fun and celebration and pleasure. The captain of the ship contacted the American Immigration and Naturalization Service, asking them to acknowledge at least the 700 immigration certificates. A telephone call was made to the State Department. Cordell Hull consulted with Franklin Delano Roosevelt, ostensibly a great president on some grounds. Franklin Roosevelt and Cordell Hull determined that it was not in the best interest of the foreign policy of the United States to interfere in the internal affairs of Nazi Germany. We will not honor the landing immigration certificates. The ship was sent out of sea on its way back to Germany. As it began to pull out of the waters of Miami Harbor, 4 or 5 elderly Jews who had gone through hell simply could not endure the knowledge that their lives, like Yen Tan later on, was to be nothing to anyone. And they jumped overboard and committed suicide. The ship came back to Europe, France took some, several hundred, England several hundred, the Low Countries several hundred. Then the Nazis made their sweep across the Low Countries, they came into France, and the St. Louis survivors in those countries ended up in ovens, concentration camps. As Elie Wiesel said about them and the 6 million and others, the sky became their cemetery. As the smoke of their bodies hurtled heavily. My friends, I'm trying to suggest to you that what happened to the Jews in Nazi Germany, that in that country of ancient Christian civilization, the country of the highest level of culture and science and technology, in that country where the demonic came to life and flourished, the Nazi Holocaust was not the work of madmen. It was not the work of cretins, of mentally retarded people. The organization and the administration of the Nazi Holocaust was the work of PhDs, people of the highest level of culture and civilization in that country in which the Reformation took place, in which the Holy Roman Empire held its seat in Aachen. I am persuaded, out of my experiences now in Asia and Africa and what I've seen in Latin America and parts of Latin America, that there is an epidemic of dehumanization in the world today. And that epidemic of dehumanization, at the heart of which is the decline in any conviction about the value of human life. The notion that human beings are expendable, they are surplus people, has its moral spiritual taproot in the Nazi experience. And the failure to confront what the emergence of evil, what the administration of evil in that advanced civilization made possible, the ignoring of it, fatigue about it, the repression about it, has laid the foundation, has created almost the psychological ecology for so much of the dreadful pattern of dehumanization that is taking place in so many other parts of the world. I stood on the shores last year of Miami, Florida. I watched the boatload of Haitians coming to the shore of the United States. I saw a mother and 7 children drown before the eyes of the Immigration and Naturalization Service that would not lift a finger to allow them to land. And all the bureaucratic arguments were the same. Now dozens allowed to drown. Last year I went with a delegation to Cambodia. Together with Liv Ullmann, Elie Wiesel, Bayard Rustin, Winston Churchill III, and another group of people from Europe, we were bringing 20 truckloads of food and medicine to Cambodia, a country where in 1975 there were 8 million people living. The Pol Pot regime, when it came to power, basing its ideology on its understanding of Adolf Hitler and Nazi Aryan superiority, sought to carry out the same program of the purification of the Cambodian people, and they set about systematically destroying half of the Cambodian population, some 4 million people. They called it zero policy year de-Westernization. And their appeal was to the fact that Hitler was able to destroy 6 million Jewish men, women, and children, that 35 million other people were destroyed in World War II, and who really cared until it was so late? Therefore, it was possible in Cambodia to do anything with people whom you regard as undesirables, and they wiped out half of the population. And we came into the edge of Cambodia. Liv Ullmann and I walked through a camp